we are joined via the phone line by Frank Parlato. FrankReport.com is where you will find his work, and he does a lot of great work on the investigative reporting front, and one of the causes he has taken up over the last several years is the Jerry Sandusky case. And Frank, first of all, good morning. Thank you for the time today.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jeff.
Frank, let's start with just a little background for folks that that don't know, haven't followed you. Give us a little of your background, and then maybe talk a little bit about how you first, we kind of touched on this a little bit Tuesday, but how you first got involved here in looking at the Jerry Sandusky case.
Well, like the rest of the world, I had been deceived by the media into naturally assuming that Jerry Sandusky was guilty. And then a man named Fred Cruz suggested to me that everything that the public knows about Jerry Sandusky is exactly the opposite of the truth. And so I made an investigation, being an investigative reporter and publisher for 30 years. It seemed like a reasonable challenge when someone would say that something that's so well known, that Sandusky is guilty of sin, is potentially a miscarriage of justice. And so I made an investigation, and I came to the conclusion that Frederick Cruz is right. Jerry Sandusky was railroaded into prison, being factually innocent.
It is one of those things, Frank, because people, I think, misconstrue that those of us that have looked at this and analyzed everything, that we think there was this mass conspiracy and everybody colluded to bring it down. It's much more. John Ziegler has described it as the perfect storm, where you had some folks that that were looking for a way anyway to remove Joe Paterno as head coach of the Penn State football program. And then the Sandusky case itself is also just fascinating in terms of the way it developed and the prosecution came to be, because again, initially you had a discredited report. It was looked into and police agreed there was nothing there. And then years later, you have I would say now fully discredited Aaron Fisher come in with his allegations, which launches this thing. And they sit idly for a couple of years because, again, nobody really believes it. And then, to me, Frank, the turning point, or at least the first big turning point, is kind of the prosecution's decision that we're going to use Sarah Ganim to get our story out. And amazingly, she ends up winning a Pulitzer Prize for giving, basically, just reporting what the prosecution was asking her to report. Am I close with my my assertions here on how this thing got started?
I think you described it as accurately as I've ever heard it described.
So you get involved and start looking into this. I guess, Frank, was there any specific thing as you're examining this, or was it just kind of a series of items that you're like, well, this couldn't have happened, or this didn't happen, that led you to the conclusion that you ultimately made that yep, in fact, Jerry Sandusky is innocent of what he's accused of doing?
Well, I think the first thing that struck me right away was that every accuser was compensated lavishly. The lowest paid accuser earned $1.5 million. The highest paid got $20 million. And all eight accusers who testified at trial received between $1.5 million and $20 million. And the more they said Sandusky did to them, essentially, the more they got paid. The second thing that struck me was that this was a case that was built largely on repressed, recovered memory, because no one made an outcry at the time it happened, or allegedly happened. So you have a case where memory paid, or false memories paid. Not a single person ever said, and it's a long time to keep things in the dark. 30 years, supposedly, he was victimizing people, and no one ever said he did so. Never. Until this bandwagon began and everyone realized that Penn State would be paying a lot of money to anyone to come forward. And so how do you explain that you said nothing happened when you talked to the police the first time and then go in and testify that you were sodomized or abused? The answer became repressed, recovered memories, a thoroughly discredited junk science that was allowed to creep into court through the judicial misconduct of the presiding judge, John Cleveland.
Multiple issues there. While that is all, I think, demonstrably true, it also has all been presented to the courts, and the courts have rejected that those are reasons for a retrial. As unjust and as ridiculous as you and I may find that, that has been what has happened. This latest filing, Frank, can you go over some of the new information that the courts ought to be considering here, that, again, ultimately should, at the very least, give Jerry Sandusky a new trial?
You know, one of Jerry's previous attorneys, Al Lindsay, said that any number of a dozen or more issues for anyone else would have resulted in a new trial. The hotel meeting, the canceling of the preliminary hearing, the fact that so many of the due process rights of Sandusky were violated. And none of that has worked so far because the state of Pennsylvania is hell-bent on not being embarrassed by this colossal miscarriage of justice. And you wonder what level of new information, newly discovered evidence will work to show a group that's embittered and determined to keep an innocent man in prison. And then we try to present that. So our newly discovered information was what we suspected all along, that the prosecutors were deeply compromised. They were incentivized and motivated to convict Sandusky on bogus repressed recovered memories. And consequently, what they did was we saw how they cheated, how they abused the process, how they got everybody hooked up with lawyers, and we smelled corruption, and then finally we've got the proof of it. And this may be unprecedented, at least I've never heard of it in recent times, but the prosecutors were dipping into the cookie jar and actually making money off of the highest paid accuser by, after he, his name is Sebastian Payton, testified to the wildest, most easily provable hassle of lies and got the most money, $20 million from Penn State. They essentially stripped him of his money and his control of the money, and they took over his, what was then, a $12 million trust. So just so you understand it, they took the money from the highest paid accuser, the two prosecutors in this case. They took his money from him, and they control it. They controlled his money. They gave him a pittance. And so you have almost the outright theft of approximately $12 or $13 million by the prosecutors who convicted Jerry Sandusky. Think about that for a moment.
Frank, I also want to get into, because while that is despicable, I can hear folks that still have doubts with Sandusky. It's like, well, yeah, okay, the prosecutors, you know, maybe not good people here, not conducting business the way it should be conducted, but them pocketing money doesn't exonerate Jerry Sandusky and these horrible things he did to these kids. To me, the most compelling evidence here is that we finally have, and I think there's some others that are, I think it's weighing heavily on them, but we do have one of the accusers, one of the so-called victims, now admitting that at the very least most of what he alleged did not occur.
That's true. They call him accuser number 10 at the trial, and he gives in his affidavit the fact that we've been alleging that the prosecution was corrupt. He talks about how he was coached, how he was pressured, how he was even bullied, and how he was told that what he doesn't remember is just plain wrong. He's got to remember that this abuse happened. And remember, these were not boys that testified. These were adult men who were testifying in court what happened to them when they were boys, things that they had forgotten and now, thanks to therapists, were remembering. So that number 10, Ryan is his name, Ryan Rittmeyer, and I give him some commendation for being courageous enough to step forward, came forward and said, yeah, here's the process. They pressured, they badgered, they insisted. They told me I was saving the world from a predator. I didn't remember. They told me that it's natural that I didn't remember. Here's what you need to do. You need to remember. And they kept pushing him to create a narrative that they wanted him to testify to. And this is exactly the same thing that another accuser's mother put in an affidavit. They changed the narrative. The young man said, no, he didn't abuse me, and they kept working on him and promising him money until his story changed to what they wanted it to be.
And, Frank, this is a pattern we've seen all throughout this case, where one of the things that drives me crazy about this case is after the conviction, it's like, well, yes, we have to believe the children. We have to believe victims when they come out. Well, which story is it that we're to believe? The one they initially tell, because nobody was believing them in the prosecution side when they came out and said, when initially asked, yeah, nothing happened. And then through, I would argue, coercion, but at the very least pressure, they changed their story, changed it a little more. Well, that's not, again, if I sit down, if we are truly to, man, we've just got to believe people when they tell us a story, well, okay, we believed them when they initially said, yeah, nothing happened, nothing untoward here, Jerry. And not only that, many of them went beyond saying not only did nothing bad happen, great things happened to them as a result of their relationship with Jerry Sandusky, their involvement in the second mile. It opened doors for them. It changed their lives for the better, is what many of these so-called victims initially told police or investigators. And then again, through a lot of pressure, I think the story's changed. And even, you know, even with Mike McQuarrie, to go to the coaching and we're going to make this story fit the narrative that we're trying to create. All you need to do is, Mike McQuarrie, probably still the most famous. If you ask the everyday people, not affiliated with Penn State, not following this closely from afar, hey, whatever happened there at Penn State, half of the people will think that Joe Paterno himself committed some kind of an act against children, because that's just the way this thing got reported. I think purposely misreported by many in the national media. But also, it would be like, well, I don't know a lot about it. I just know there was that that one coach that saw Jerry Sandusky raping that boy in the shower. And one, that isn't what he said. It isn't what he testified to. They changed that testimony in the grand jury presentment. And also, Jerry Sandusky was found not guilty on that count. That is not one of the reasons Jerry Sandusky is now in jail. But, Frank, would you agree? I mean, most people, again, they're not delving into this case. They're reading the news headlines and they're moving on with their lives, as you would expect people to do. But I would guess the overwhelming majority of folks, why is Jerry Sandusky in prison? Oh, yeah, that one coach saw a boy being raped by Jerry Sandusky, and so, they had to put him away.
Right. That's exactly how this thing really germinated. A false report, a mistaken report, and a co-opted report by McQuarrie turned into a media frenzy, and none of it was true.
And nobody to this day, Frank, Wright has been held accountable for that. I mean, it was a flat-out lie. Mike McQuarrie will tell you that part is a lie. We went from hearing slapping sounds, which is what Mike McQuarrie said occurred. He heard slapping sounds in the locker room. We went from that to, in the grand jury presentment, that Mike McQuarrie witnessed anal penetration. Well, that is one hell of a change in the story actually told and the story presented by, I would argue, I mean, I don't know how you could possibly not call this prosecution team corrupt. That is preposterous to change it to that degree and have nobody to this day held accountable for that.
I agree with you. The fact is they changed his grand jury testimony from what he actually said to what they wrote in the grand jury presentment. They changed it. They fraudulently, maliciously changed his testimony to say that he saw a case of sodomy. And if you think about it on its face, Jeff, it's a stupid, really stupid charge. According to the presentment, he raped this 10-year-old boy, and then they walked out of the place like it was a mutually consensual rape. I think the first question one would ask is, why would you be in a public facility and do that? If you can rape at will, why do you need to do it in public, in a shower? It just doesn't make sense. And even the jury, prejudiced though they were, with all the publicity, even they couldn't buy into that story the prosecution told. And so he was acquitted on the very charge that made the case famous.
We're going to take a break here. When we come back, I want to get your perspective, Frank, on the other so-called victims, the accusers here in this case, and kind of where we stand right now with them and their very large payouts and just kind of the way many of their lives now are unfolding. I just want to delve into that a little bit. On the other side of this break, again, Frank Parlato, investigative reporter, joining us. You can read his work on the Jerry Sandusky case and many other cases. He does a lot of great investigative work. FrankReport.com is where you will find his work, FrankReport.com, and we are back after this.
Your home for the Goon and Ironhead.
Ironhead and the Goon.
Exclusively on Sports Radio 98.7.
The Fox. The Fox Sports. is your Sunday home for the National Football League. All of the big teams.
Spins into the end zone. Touchdown, Kansas City.
Big names.
Burrow throws over the middle into coverage, and it is caught. Unbelievable.
It's the NFL. Sundays
on Central PA Sports Authority.
The Fox Sports Weekend. Sports Radio 98.7. The Fox. Fox Sports.
You know, a hotel's just a hotel, but a house is a home.
Decorated to perfection with pride, love, and attention to detail. That's what you'll experience when you stay at the Keller House.
A delightful 1887 home in the village of Center Hall, Pennsylvania.
The Keller House is not just a bed and breakfast. The moment you open the door, you'll be amazed at the historic, unique, cozy feel of this beautiful Victorian home. The Keller House is just minutes away from State College. So if you're going to the game, turn your trip into a mini vacation. The Keller House Bed and Breakfast. Oh, and did I mention the delicious homemade cooked breakfasts? So good. Plus, you can choose from one of five themed bedrooms, each with its own bathroom and a central sitting room downstairs. Wireless high-speed internet is also provided. So, whether you're by yourself or bringing the whole family, the Keller House Bed and Breakfast in Center Hall will be your home away from home. KellerHouseBB.com. That's KellerHouseBB.com. 109 West Church Street, Center Hall.
Seasons change, and so does the equipment you need to handle those changes. From mowing to harvesting and taking care of snow, Dodder Equipment just south of Mill Hall on Route 64 has what you need to get it done. Still doing construction? Kubota has all the equipment you need. For landscaping, Dodder Equipment has what you need with equipment from Kubota, Steel, and Land Pride. The outdoors isn't all work and no play. Kubota, Honda Power Sports, and Suzuki have that fun covered too. And Dodder Equipment just south of Mill Hall on Route 64 has them all. Want to keep your home warm and cozy? Check out the Crown Royal Outdoor Furnaces. If you're cutting your own firewood, Dodder Equipment is your steel dealer with a saw that fits your needs perfectly. Dodder Equipment for Kubota, Honda Power Sports, Suzuki, Land Pride, Steel, Crown Royal Outdoor Furnaces, and a great selection of trailers and accessories. See it all now at Dodder Equipment, just south of Mill Hall on Route 64. Visit us online at DodderEquipment.com.
This is Jim Galante from the Keystone Sports Network. For the best Penn State football analysis and commentary, join me, Dustin Hawkinsmith, T. Frank Carr, Andy Shea, and Jeff Byers every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox and State College. We'll bring you game reviews, player evaluation, recruiting news, and plenty more on the Nittany Lions. That's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 3 p.m. right here on Fox Sports 98.7 for the Keystone Kickoff Show.
It's Let's Talk here on a Thursday morning. Jeff Byers and Scott Giese with you. We are joined by Frank Parlato. FrankReport.com is the website. You can find all of his work, including an awful lot of work that he has done on behalf of Jerry Sandusky. Again, initially, just looking into the case, seeing what was or wasn't true. And a lot of your work, Frank, has really been on the I call them the accusers. Legally, I get it. They're victims. That's what they were found in a court of law. But you've spent an awful lot of time looking into them, contacting them, trying to get them to do the right thing, to tell the truth. I guess maybe just delve in a little bit to the work you've done there and kind of where we stand now as a group. And I know it's a little different with each individual, but as a group, kind of what where you think we're at and where we could be headed with the group. And in specific, I guess, Frank, because, again, there's the folks that got paid from Penn State, and then there's the much smaller subset of individuals that actually testified at the trial against Jerry Sandusky.
That's correct, yes. The bandwagon effect is what happened. You know, it's a funny thing. Charlie Kirk, a week before he died, he went on YouTube, and he spoke about how Sandusky, Jerry Sandusky, was a victim of the bandwagon effect and of the gold rush. He understood, like many thinking people do, that this was a miscarriage of justice. And I was ready to get into discourse with him when he was lamentably assassinated. And I think thinking people can recognize what happened if they studied the case. And what I thought would be the best approach was to reach out to people involved in the trial, the witnesses, the accusers. And so far I've had two witnesses essentially recant. And I spoke with the mother of one of the accusers who said that her son didn't tell the truth about the number of visits he made to Jerry Sandusky. So we've discredited, and this is all in this new filing for a new trial, three of the eight we have known and proven lies. That's a start. We got five more to go. But I think before that, what will happen is an evidentiary hearing where we can bring in everybody and start what might even be a new mini trial to show the lies and the bandwagon effect, the gold rush. This everybody knew there was going to be money, and so they took advantage of that. I think we'll have an evidentiary hearing, and I think we'll find some amazing, shocking new discoveries, and I think then there will be a new trial.
I want to share your optimism on the evidentiary hearing. I don't think there's any question that it should occur. I guess my question to you would be, what gives you faith that the Pennsylvania court system will do the right thing here? As you mentioned earlier, the number of items that have been brought before the courts in previous petitions that are clearly that where cases have been granted retrials based on the exact same arguments, and in this case, though, not so much. What gives you faith or confidence that that this will be different with the evidence that is going to that is being presented here?
Well, I think there's one major difference this time. They now have a fall guy. They were looking to protect themselves because they couldn't possibly admit, the judiciary, the attorney general, they couldn't possibly admit that they got it this wrong, that they had an honest system and then it turned out convicting a guilty person, convicting a person who is actually not guilty and turning them into guilty through the fault of the system. However, now they have someone that's far guiltier, the prosecutors. They have their fall guy. The two prosecutors cheated. It's clear and evident that they cheated. They I would call it stealing money. That's my opinion. But they certainly took control of their victim's money. So, Jeff, now they have an excuse. Well, it wasn't us. It wasn't our bad judiciary. It wasn't our system. We weren't corrupt. But we found a rotten couple of prosecutors, and now we can blame it on them and say, okay, we have to do something. Now, what's the alternative? If they don't do something, this is only going to expand. This corruption is not going away. We've caught the prosecutors red-handed. That's a little different than anything. It's not anymore Jerry's innocent. We now have proof that the prosecutors are guilty.
Yeah.
All right. Frank, this is Scott. Let me jump in with a couple of questions. Jeff is very passionate about this one, so I'm just kind of sitting back and listening. Let me start with that last thing. Now, I'm just like an outside observer, okay? And especially on social media, it seems like there's a growing number of people saying, no, wait a minute, something smells here. Something's not right. And I've read, I would say, comments from multiple people who've said, if Sandusky and his group, you know, the supporters and whatever, if they continue to pursue this in state court, they're never going to get anywhere. That somebody will shut them down in state court every time, and that if they actually want to try to get some headway, I guess federal court would have to be the next level, that they're going to have to go there. I don't know, Frank, do you have any kind of opinions on that? You're a bit of an optimist. There is a lot of pessimists, like my friend here, that state court is going to stop them cold every time. I don't know, what do you think about any of that?
Well, that is a valid and much-argued theory, and it may wind up being true. Here is the secret to the whole concept. In order to take it to federal court, you must exhaust all of your arguments in state court first. So what that means is, if we want to bring the corruption of the prosecutors, if we want to bring the recantations of these witnesses, we can't just jump to federal court. First, we have to take it to state court, which we're doing now. And if we're again rebuffed, then we can take our complete package with all of the issues we've raised since day one and bring it to federal court, which is precisely what we'll do if the state court again refuses to look at this overwhelming evidence.
The whole idea, Frank, of repressed memory, I've never understood. All right, now I'm no legal expert, I'm not a psychologist, or none of those things, obviously. But in your research and the stories that you've done, have you, I don't know, maybe done any kind of research on repressed memories? Has this actually been used in some other case, some other time, and then it was absolutely conclusively proven that, yes, those repressed memories were accurate, this did happen, or some such thing? Because for me, repressed memories seem so gray and squishy. And what's to stop somebody, you've kind of alluded to this, of just making it all up? You know, like that hole-in-one I had on the Penn State golf courses a few years ago. Oh, Jeff, you should have seen it. It was great. Oh, what a great hole-in-one I had.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was playing alone and nobody was with me and nobody saw it, but oh, it was an amazing shot. And I totally make it up. And so, Frank, the idea of repressed memory, like, has this actually been used somewhere else? And it's conclusively proven that it was accurate, because it seems so doggone squishy to me on that.
I don't know of any instance. I think back in 1996, the consensus was pretty much that it's the opposite is true. The brain works a little differently when you are hurt. When you experience trauma, you don't typically forget it. You remember it. It's a protective mechanism in the brain. You don't forget that which hurts you. The mind works that you remember it, so you avoid it in the future. I've never heard of it working. I've never heard of it being proven. I've only heard that it's been debunked.
Yeah, it is just hard to, because again, most of these allegations involved boys that were 10 years or older, and a lot of the accusations came in the teenage years. And the idea that you would repress something that recent at that age, I just and again, if you read Mark Pendergrass' book, the Most Hated Man in America, it's pretty revealing, and to me, kind of clearly discredits a lot of what was ultimately used to convict Jerry Sandusky in this particular case. Frank, just procedurally, can you take us through where we're at now? The petition has been filed. What's the timeline we're looking at now for the next step or steps?
I believe that we filed it 2 weeks ago. The prosecution, the Attorney General's office, has, I think they've asked for an extension, so they have, I believe, 90 days to reply. then there'll be some, there may be a further response on our part, and then there'll be a decision on an evidentiary hearing. That could take a few more months. And then if we get an evidentiary hearing, then we will bring witnesses and present evidence, which I think would be very compelling. And if that fails, as Scott alluded to, then we would immediately move forward into federal court.
So this would be the last attempt through the Pennsylvania court system. If this fails, the plan is to go to federal court.
Speaking from my perspective, and I believe this is the consensus of the attorneys and Jerry Sandusky, that would be the plan. But as I say, you can only raise issues in federal court that you previously raised in state court. You can't just go in with brand new issues. You got to start at the state, get rejected, and then go to federal. Now we have such a, and then we can start all over again. And federal, we would bring everything, all of the things that were rejected by the state court. And when you add those all up together, it would be impossible to ignore the unfair trial that Jerry Sandusky experienced.
Frank, this is my pessimistic side. It's been 13 years, but, I mean, what's different with Pennsylvania State Court in 13 years? I'm thinking some of the same cast of characters is probably there someplace, and if they blew it the first time, what's to stop them from doing it the second time? I guess I'm a pessimist there.
Well, I think we can only, in time, discover whether there is any desire to do justice. That maybe you could argue, and the pessimists would, that there is none on the part of Pennsylvania. So let's say that that's true. There's no interest in justice. It's all about protecting their image and their name. If there's enough of a groundswell, enough evidence and enough that the public understands and the public is beginning to understand, then and only then do I think they move towards doing the right thing.
Frank, I should know this, and I don't, Frank. Have you done a story that, let's say that over time, this year, next year, whatever, this actually gets overturned, and it's proven that Jerry Sandusky was actually innocent? Who would stand to lose if that would actually happen? Because, Frank, just kind of looking on the outside in, it's a mountain of people and groups that would stand to lose if this would actually be overturned. That sounds like a story lead. Maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe you've done it already. I mean, just right off top of your head, who stands to lose if this actually takes place?
Well, you know, I think reputationally some people will lose, but I don't know they can claw back any of the money. It's been 13 years or 10 years, depending on the accuser. I don't think anybody will have to make any repayments. I think it's a reputational issue with a lot of people, from former Governor Corbett and the prosecutors and possibly the governor of the state of Pennsylvania, may have a reputational discord and may even prevent some of them who still have ambition from rising farther.
What about Penn State University as a whole, Frank? Don't they stand to lose if this gets overturned?
You know, I think that might be maybe the reason why they're so steadfastly unwilling to look at their role in this travesty. Maybe they would. I consider them an institution of lower learning, and I would be astonished if anybody came to me and said they're going to Penn State. I would, you know, not to be disrespectful, but what they did was not an example of higher learning. It was sacrificing a man for a football team. Would they lose? I don't know. You guys would be a better judge of that. If they suddenly veered toward the truth and said, we are, after all, an institution of higher learning. If we had lower understanding, we now have a higher understanding. He's innocent. We will work for his vindication. It's quite possible that they would gain respect and look back at the trustees at that time and say, well, they were wrong, and let's always head toward the truth.
In a sane world, that is exactly what would happen. I do wonder about it. Frank, I did want to just pick up one more thread that we touched on at the start, and you actually explained, but I want to just delve a little bit further in to how unusual, because looking at this from afar, again, when the grand jury presentment was made, I thought that was just a list of facts, and I, like everybody else, was horrified. I'm like, oh my God, Jerry Sandusky was seen. Like, Mike McQuarrie isn't going to make up a story about seeing somebody rape a child. So I'm buying into this. This is horrific. And they go and tell Joe, and Joe doesn't do anything. It's man, I'm hook, line, and sinker, because I just, again, naively, did not know about the fact that, yeah, you can just make crap up in a grand jury presentation. Yeah, but no basis at all, in fact. We can just put it in there. Well, I stupidly did not know that. So I also am not real familiar, just not been around them, where you, me or my friends or family members have ever had a multi-million-dollar settlement. Can you just talk, because you are around these types of paydays and have looked into these types of cases, just how unusual it is that the prosecution sets up the trust fund for a victim in this case. And I read through the story, Frank. I'm still a little confused. Like, how did that come about? Why did the victim allow it? There's nothing about that makes sense to me. But again, I don't know. Maybe this is, I'm reading through it. I'm like, well, I don't know. Maybe most lawyers set up trust funds. That seems really weird to me. Yeah. But I don't know how this stuff works. How unusual is it? And can you talk us through what you know about how this came to be?
Well, I think it's highly unusual. And you can see how it's rife for a conflict. You're a prosecutor, and you coach your witness, and then you take control of the money he gets in a civil suit. You can see how that's right for dishonest prosecutors and dishonest witnesses. In the case of Sebastian Payton, he originally told the prosecutors nothing happened. But they also saw that he was kind of a malleable, easily influenced young man who could be coached better than any of the other eight. The other eight were a little more grasping. They understood. They knew what they were going to get, millions, and they cooked up with lawyers quickly. Payton didn't have a civil lawyer. He went to McGettigan, the prosecutor, and said, you'll be my lawyer. And McGettigan said, you bet. And that's exactly what happened. Keep in mind this too, Jeff, that Payton's story was the wildest. It was the most fantastical. It was a story that nobody on earth would believe, except for the bandwagon of all these other guys making their lies. Payton's story was on steroids. He was locked in the basement every single weekend. This is his story. For 3 years, locked in Sandusky's basement, which he said was soundproof, and starved in the basement and sodomized and abused every weekend for 3 years, not when he was 8, 7, or 6, but when he was 13, 14, and 15 years old, sodomized for 3 days, starved, and screaming for help. Dottie Sandusky wouldn't come and rescue him. No one would help him. Why? Because it was a soundproof basement, he said. And here's the question that his attorney, Jerry's attorney, should have asked. Well, wait a second, son. You say every single weekend you were there, starved, abused, screaming for help, raped. Then you went to school and said nothing. And then he came back the next weekend and did it all over again. His story was fantastic. However, everybody knew that Penn State was paying on any story anyone cared to tell. The prosecutors knew that they were going to hit the jackpot on this one, and they did. Hayden got more than double what any other accuser got, and the prosecutors took control of that money. They took his money, and they took control of it, and they handed him $1,000 a week on $12 million. Now, you think about the low rate of return. They controlled his money. They set up what they wanted. One of the prosecutors was the trustee. The girlfriend of the other prosecutor was the other trustee. Actually, it was part of a trust committee of three. And the third one was Payden's handpicked therapist. So that anytime he acted up, the therapist could just say, well, you're crazy. You can't have your money. And they took control of $12 million. That was their real payday for this case.
Truly incredible. Frank, we thank you for the time. Thank you for all of the work you've done on this case. And obviously, we will continue to follow closely and stay in touch. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, guys. Take care.